is Over the Garden Gate, a program brought to you by the University of California Cooperative Extension Master Gardener Program of Tuolumne County. The mission of the UCCE Master Gardeners is to provide research-based gardening information to the public. If you would like to contact our Master Gardener Program, please call our hotline, which is area code 209-533-5912. The hotline is not manned full-time, but we do pick up our messages and we will get back to you within the week.
Hello, everybody. This is Debbie Powell, Master Gardener Coordinator for both Calaveras and Tuolumne Counties. We're still sheltering in place, but we're still continuing with the radio shows, and we're really fortunate today to have Marianne Chambers, longtime Tuolumne Master Gardener, talking to us about all those pesky bugs we can find on the veggies we're growing this season. Hello, Marianne.
Hi, Debbie. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing really great. And I'm looking at where you're sitting. It's beautiful. And I see your tomato plants on your deck, which is great. Have you been having any problems with things attacking your tomato plants at all?
No, actually, I've been pretty lucky this year. They're pretty much isolated. But one of the things that I have been noticing a lot, I also have a garden plot in the Twain Hart Community Center. And there's been a lot of bird damage this year. So the birds have been coming in and they'll start nipping at the leaves. Finches are pretty much notorious for that. The swallows are building their nest and they're having their babies. So a lot of the damage that you're seeing is not insect, it's actually bird damage. So they just kind of rip the leaves a little bit.
So if they're ripping the leaves, does it look jagged or does it look torn or what?
It looks torn a little bit jagged. It's not like a typical feeding area where it's usually a uniform type eating. It's kind of like a random.
And okay.
So that kind of gives you an indication that it's a bird.
Do they have a preference for certain vegetable plants, or do they prefer the young ones do they just go after everything?
They just go after everything. Actually, the biggest thing that they will go after, they really love sunflowers.
Sunflowers?
So they really like the leaves on sunflowers.
Oh.
And part of that is because the leaf on a sunflower is so big, they can actually land on the plant itself. And that way pull up some of the plant material.
I have to admit, I never realized that. It's a landing pad.
It's a landing pad.
For the birds.
Yep, it's a landing pad. So I think we have had a lot of earwig problems. But a lot of it has been birds. Birds and earwigs, I would say.
How can you tell the difference as far as the damage between earwigs and birds, or is it impossible to tell the difference?
Well, it kind of depends. When the damage is up about a foot off the ground, you know that it's not an earwig. So earwigs like more tender, younger plants.
Okay.
So low to the ground where they can stay under the cover, where the birds are going to be a little bit higher.
Okay, so what is your solution to the birds? I mean, we don't want to do anything really drastic.
No, and you know.
And you're not allowed to do anything drastic to birds. Aren't they protected?
Well, it depends. There's quite a few pest notes that are available through UC that discuss bird damage. And particular birds, they'll have swallows and they'll have one on woodpeckers, because a lot of people call about woodpeckers. So you can look up on that. Yeah, the bird status is kind of interesting, and I'd rather give somebody the information than tell them really what to do. But birds are difficult. So you can put up reflector mylar, like old CDs, or wind chimes or something like that to distract them, because they don't like to have a lot of movement around.
But, okay.
They will go on and they will migrate as the babies get older, and they'll go on to other things.
So they're only around for a certain period of time.
Yes.
They're not going to, it's not going to be a permanent housing of birds that are always going to be attacking.
Yeah, until the fruit comes on and then they'll come back.
How about what is another probably common pesky problem to attack vegetables or fruits?
The earwigs have been probably the number one this year. And so UC has a great pest note about earwigs, and it's basically cutting off the top of a tuna can or a cat food can and burying it where the top of the can is level with the soil. And you can fill it up with oil, or some people swear by soy sauce, and that actually attracts the earwigs away from your plants.
Oh!
So you can do that. You can use a diatomaceous earth.
And how do you
spread it out underneath your plant?
Does it have to be thick, or does it have to be like a solid covering?
It has to be a uniform covering. So it's diatomaceous earth is tiny diatoms. So it basically, if they try to ingest it, it basically cuts them up from the inside.
Oh.
But that has to be reapplied. Wherever you put it, whenever you water, because the minute you add water to it, it'll go away.
Now, is it harmful to the soil at all, or does it do anything?
No,
okay.
No. The other one is a product called Sluggo 2, and it has to be Sluggo 2, and it's basically an iron phosphate and a active ingredient called spinosad, and spinosad is an organic product that is very selective on what it wants to get rid of. So you don't have to worry about your beneficial insects or anything like that. And that's in a pelletized form that you could put around your plant, and the earwigs will feed on that, and then they'll die out. So you have lots of choices of what to do.
But okay.
I would say the earwigs have been busy this summer.
Yeah, it seems like there's been an unusual amount of earwigs this year.
Yeah, well, our weather has been so goofy that I think that has a contribution to it.
Okay, and then you were talking earlier before we started recording about, was it cucumber beetle?
The western spotted cucumber beetle, which is it looks like a ladybug that is yellow with black dots on it.
It sounds attractive.
They are attractive. There's two. There's also the striped cucumber beetle. And they're both very difficult to control. So one of the things that we have found, back to down to the community garden that I'm in, we had to get rid of our compost pile.
Why?
The compost pile was harboring a lot of these insects over the winter, so that when everybody started planting, the cucumber beetles just knew where to go. So we had eliminated them for several years by removing the compost pile. And all of a sudden they seem to be back this year. And so I think it might have been too, we really didn't have a harsh winter. We kind of had a mild winter.
Right.
The cold didn't really kill them off. Hand picking is one thing. They're actually very good flyers. So you will find them on your other vegetable plants, but they really like the cucurbits, so they really like the squash and the cucumbers. And what they'll do is they'll start damaging the buds, and you won't get any vegetables. So the only thing that I have found that has been really successful in controlling them is beneficial nematodes, which is something people don't think about that often. So I'm off of Amazon. I don't know anybody else who carries beneficial nematodes. You can inoculate your garden beds with it. And they'll last for about 1 or 2 years. I used to do it every other year.
Now, can you see the nematodes?
No, they're microscopic. So they're basically microscopic worms. And probably the most famous nematode to a gardener would be root rot nematode on tomatoes, which is a bad nematode.
But, so there's good and bad nematodes.
There's good and bad nematodes. And so these are the good ones. So it's kind of funny. They're freeze dried. So when you get them, it's you use like an old fashioned ice cream carton, like a little half pint carton, and it'll have vermiculite in it. And what they've done is they've put basically freeze-dried the nematodes, and they're in the vermiculite. You put that mixture in a jar that's at least 1 or 2 gallons, and you add about 1 gallon or 2 of water, and you let them sit for a couple hours. And what happens is the nematodes extract out of the vermiculite, and then you sprinkle it on and pour it onto your garden bed, and the nematodes will get established and start going to work.
Now, do you have to prepare the soil ahead of time to accept the nematodes? I mean, does the soil have to be kind of damp, or?
I would say that the soil would have to be a little bit damp. This will help with cabbage loopers. It'll actually help with definitely the spotted cucumber beetle and the striped cucumber beetle. It'll work on, to an extent, the tomato hornworm, depending on which strain you get. So you really kind of have to do a little research and look up the beneficial nematodes, and it'll tell you what they're good for. They're used a lot for lawn grubs, where you can spray your lawn and get rid of the grubs that way, so that way you don't have raccoons digging up your lawn or anything like that.
Right.
And so you really have to do a little research. They've been used a lot. They're great for fleas if you have a flea problem. And they're wonderful for flies. They have a bunch for flies. They have some for white flies, and they have some for flies like a livestock type.
Okay. Now, how often would you say that you have to add these beneficial nematodes to your soil? Is it just once a year, maybe, or?
It's just once a year. Once a year, or once every 2 years, depending on where you are. So if you're in an area that you're really not watering that much, you'd probably have to get them established a little more, but they can last for up to 2 years.
Yeah. And then I'm assuming that if the conditions are right, they'll just keep on going.
Yeah, they'll keep on going as long as they have something to feed on, like anything else. So they won't kill everything off, but they'll maintain their own food supply.
Yeah. How about tomatoes as far as the hornworms?
Well, actually, the best thing is to actually use Bacillus thuringiensis, which is specifically for Lepidoptera species, and that's great for hornworms, but you also have to keep in mind that that's also going to get any moth and butterfly. It's only selective to moths and butterflies, so that means it's going to kill them all. So kind of your choice on how you want to deal with that.
Okay.
Because some people want to keep their other butterflies instead of killing them.
Right, like monarchs. I mean, we're all trying to save monarchs.
Yeah, but I haven't seen a monarch eat on a tomato plant yet. Because.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah, good point. Milkweed only.
Milkweed only.
Well, Marion, do you have any last tips for us before we have to?
Well, I would say, so now we're coming into a heat wave, and so we've had up and down heat. A lot of people have had aphid problems, and that's now going to go away with the heat. So you're always going to see a cycle of insects. Nothing is completely 100% clean. You're just going to have that tolerance. But it's when they're really damaging your fruit or your vegetables is when you really want to have to worry and kind of take action. The UCIPM website is a wonderful resource for people to go and look up specific damage on specific crops. And back to, they can download the quick tips or the pest notes. And UC's done a lot of research in that area.
And don't forget, they could always call the hotline.
They can call the hotline. I like the email.
I like the email.
Because the email, you can, we really encourage people to send photos. It's a lot easier to help diagnose an issue when you have a photo. So the email for the Master Gardener hotline is mgtuolumne, T-U-O-L-U-M-N-E, @ucdavis.edu.
Hey, thank you, Marion. We ran out of time. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, Debbie.
Thank you.
This is KAADLP 103.5 FM, Sonora, California.
Hello, everybody. This is Debbie Powell, the Master Gardener of Calaveras and Tuolumne County. And I'm so fortunate. I'm at the Demonstration Garden today here in Sonora, which is the Demonstration Garden is located on 251 South Beretta Street here in downtown Sonora. Also, I guess, known as Casina Alternative High School. Well, that's the name of it. Otherwise, another description would be at the Dome. And I am talking to Tuolumne Master Gardener Chase Anderson. Hello, Chase.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing very well.
And Chase has a really interesting hobby. I just find it fascinating. And the reason I find it fascinating is I love them, number one. And then the second is I know nothing about them. I'm completely ignorant of the subject. And you have a koi pond, and you even raise water-loving plants that are in the koi pond. So my first question for you is, how did you get interested in that?
Well, I've always loved fish, and as a kid and even adult, I had fish tanks. And so about 15 years ago, I thought I'd like a pond. So I dug a hole in the ground with a jackhammer, and I lined it with a rubber liner and put in a little filter, and initially started with some goldfish, and then started adding some small koi and began reading about koi. And when I lost some of them to blue herons, I decided I needed a much bigger pond. So I began.
Why is that?
If a pond is deep enough, at least has an area that's deep enough where the fish can escape to. Neither raccoons nor herons can get to them, and that's about 3.5 to 4 feet deep. So I built a pond that was about 2,000 gallons, roughly 12 feet by 8 feet, and it had some shelves, but the deepest end was 48 inches deep. And I've had that pond for 13 years, and I've never lost a fish to a raccoon.
Really?
or a heron. I have raccoon prints all the way around it, but
so
they can't
trying.
Get them. They're interested.
They're interested.
That's for sure. And then I retired in 2011, so I dug a second pond. So I really have two koi ponds now, neither one of which is very large. One's 1,000 gallons and one's 2,000 gallons, but I'm able to keep in the larger pond some koi that are 22 to 24 inches long, and they probably weigh 7 or 8 pounds. So there's some big fish there. And as you said, I've come to know which water plants are compatible with the ponds. And I've also, through trial and error, figured out ways to have the koi spawn. And I've raised a couple of sets of koi fry, 300 or 400.
And that means koi babies? Fry.
Yeah, the babies
the eggs.
You know, collected the eggs, had them hatch in a tank.
Oh my gosh, how fascinating.
Yeah, it's real fun. It's like, for me, as a master gardener, I propagate a lot of trees.
Yes, and you do a great job.
And have learned how to do that by trial and error. And the idea of propagating fish, raising them from eggs is real intriguing. My biggest problem is finding friends that I can give all the babies to.
Aww, to give all the babies to?
When you have 300 or 400 baby koi, the vast majority are unattractive. You know, you get a few very pretty ones. And so I'm always looking for people who... I don't have any right now, so I'm not looking for people to say, hey, give me some fish. But in the past 5 years, I've raised a couple of spawns and sort of wore out my friends by asking them, hey, you want some fish? And they say, no, don't ask me again. I'm not taking any of your fish.
That is too funny. Now, just kind of curious, with these fish, do you have to have plants in the ponds, or is that just merely aesthetic? I mean,
you have to have a filtration system that keeps the water clean and clear. That's the most important thing in raising fish, raising koi, is quality of the water. Plants add to the quality of water. You know, the same thing they do in nature, down some of the nitrites, which are from fish waste. Too much food, rotting leaves create nitrites, and the healthy bacteria turn the nitrites into nitrates, which are much less harmful. And the you know, the nitrogen cycle of plant life also occurs in pond as well. So the objective is to have good water, and water plants add to the quality of water.
Oh, okay.
So you don't have to have them if you have a great filtration system. You see beautiful ponds on YouTube or on TV, Japanese ponds. Mm-hmm. There are many people that have heated indoor ponds, and there's no water plants, but they have incredible filtration systems.
Okay.
So quality water is what will... Poor quality is what will make fish sick, and good quality is what keeps them thriving.
Oh, right. Great. Now, going to the plant area, what kind of plants do you have in your ponds?
I began by taking some of the wild iris out of the Woods Creek bed by Sonora High. I retired from Sonora High, so I'd collect just a clump of the wild iris and put them in a pot. And they thrive because they're like, you know, they grow next to creeks. And matter of fact, in a pond setting, you have to keep them in pots or they become almost invasive and will grow everywhere. They do really well. The other thing that years ago I bought a canna lily at a pawn shop, and the canna lilies do really well. But then I tried just regular canna lilies that you could buy at Lowe's or anywhere, and if you put them in a pot and put some rocks around them to hold them down, whether there's much soil or not, they'll thrive in a pond.
They don't mind being submerged.
No.
And they're actually, do you submerge them all the way to the crown of the plant?
I put the top of the pot just below the surface of the water, so they're completely submerged, and they'll grow 4 or 5 feet high above the water.
Oh my gosh. Do they bloom even?
They do,
growing in the water?
Yeah.
Because they're beautiful.
They're
so tropical.
And you know, when you see canna lilies in people's gardens, if they're not really well watered, pretty soon the leaves start to dry or show water stress, or they get crisp or brown. It never happens when they're in a pond.
When they're in a pond. Isn't that something?
So those are the two natural ones. I bought parrot's feather, which is a beautiful plant. If you don't keep your fish well fed, koi especially will nibble at
I didn't even think about them wanting to eat.
Parrot's feather. And then the other popular pond plant is, you know, water lilies, the lotus plants. Goldfish won't, but koi will nibble around the edges of the big leaves. And so some people avoid those in koi ponds. But if the koi are well fed, they leave the plant life
alone?
Pretty much alone.
They will focus on the fish food, and I'm assuming because they like it better.
Yeah.
And they would prefer it.
Yeah. But they do like some green. When I make a salad, and if I have romaine lettuce, I cut some of the tender green tips off and throw them in the koi pond. When the miner's lettuce comes up in the spring around my house, I cut off some of the tenderest ones and throw them in the koi pond.
Maybe describe miner's lettuce, what that looks like.
I wish I could tell you what the real name is. It's just a plant that grows around here.
But it's saucer shape. That's kind of
the leaves
are bent. And then
tiny white blossoms.
Right. But I've learned when it blooms, then the leaves become bitter.
Bitter, right.
Yeah.
But when they first come up
when
and
they
they're
first
tender,
come up.
You can just pick them and eat them
or
add them to your own salad.
I know. They're so good. They're actually, at that point, almost... I want to say almost a sweet quality.
Yeah.
I mean, they're very, very good. So,
so
good
the koi
to hear
like
that.
A little bit
they
of
like
green,
it too.
And that's I think that's why they nibble on the leaves of the water lilies. So you know, there are I know a fella who had a koi pond and was tired of all the work of keeping the water clear with filtration and the fact that he loved plants and the koi kept nibbling his plants. So he ended up making it a pond for plants and took all the fish out.
Oh, okay.
I like I love seeing the fish.
Oh, yeah, they are, the movement.
And they're calming, and different fish have different personalities. I know this starts to sound silly, but...
No, I was wondering about that. I've had friends that have had fish, and they've named them. The fish recognize them. Do they recognize you?
Well, when I come to a certain spot, they come rushing over, but whether it's recognizing me or just knowing that's where I usually feed them, I'm not sure. But there are... Ogon is a Japanese word for a single-colored fish. A platinum ogon is white, and the ogons are particularly friendly. They get large, and they're the ones that most often you can train to eat out of your hand. Most of the names for koi are Japanese names. The Japanese originally raised carp alongside the rice patties, and the carp were for food. And then Japanese farmers noticed occasionally that these carp, very similar to the ones you can see in Maloney's or Don Pedro, the big black carp, had some scale mutations, a red scale here or a white scale there. And so they collected those and bred the ones with scale mutations. And all of the koi we have now and the many varieties, which are judged in competitions in all around the world, come from the crossbreeding of koi color mutations.
How interesting.
So, you know, the reds and the whites and the blacks and even the blues.
I didn't even know there was a blue.
There are a couple of varieties. Something called a soggy is orange belly, orange fin, blue back with reticulated scales like pine cone.
I bet that's beautiful.
Goshiki is a koi that has, they could say five colors, but it's really red, white, black, blue, and brown. And the blue isn't sky blue, but it's a darker blue.
Sure.
So there are a couple that have blue in them.
Now, do you have all these range of colors in your koi pond, all these different types?
My smaller koi pond, I have favorite types. The most popular type of koi is kohaku. That's white with red marking.
Okay.
Sanke is white with red and black. Showa is, in theory, black skin with white and red. Those are the three most popular. I have an example of each of those. I love asagis, orange belly, blue back, so I have one in each of the koi ponds. I have one in each of a couple of 100-gallon tanks I have in the house.
Oh, my gosh. And so you even have them in the house, and you can do that.
I do. They don't get nearly as large because they grow to the size of their environment, and so they won't get very large in tanks. But, and when I was raising babies... Koi in the pond would spawn on a spawning rope. It looks like a big bottle brush of sorts. And then remove that before they could eat all the eggs, which they are wont to do. Mm-hmm. Put those in a fish tank in the house with some aeration, a little bit of antifungal. And in 3 or 4 days, you have hundreds of babies.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I raised them in fish tanks in the house until they were an inch and a half to 2 inches before I'd put them in somebody's pond.
Chase, this has been so fascinating. And what you just described absolutely sounds magical to me.
It's really fun. It's magical. A hobby.
We'll talk again. But for right now, we ran out of time. I want to thank you so much. This has been great. And goodbye.
You bet. Happy to do it. See you later.
You've been listening to Over the Garden Gate, a program presented by the UCCE Master Gardeners of Tuolumne County. I'm Linda Reevely. Thank you for being with us. If you would like to contact us for more information, remember you can contact our hotline, which is area code 209-533-5912, or you can look us up on the kaad-lp.org website. Look for Over the Garden Gate. Thank you.